Away with Words, Part 3, Lecture 4. G-H-O-T-I spells fish.
I entitled this lecture, G-H-O-T-I spells fish. And it's a lecture about the English spelling system. And by the end of the lecture, I will explain to you how possibly G-H-O-T-I could spell fish. But let's talk for just a minute about where we are and the spelling system and how it fits into grammar. Because technically, the spelling system doesn't really seem like it's part of grammar. Remember, grammar is the way we arrange words to make meaning. And spelling sort of operates at a lower level. It indicates how sounds are put together to make words. And technically, that would mean that grammar is syntactic and bits of grammar are morphological and spelling is phonetic or phonosyntactic. I mean, you get very tangled with phonomorphological and so forth. I'm not going to get into all those technical terms and worrying about it that much, but I want to say that spelling, as we're talking about it, is not really a part of grammar, but it still belongs in this course. And the reason is that in my experience, people, when they're worried about their grammar in their writing, not in their speaking, obviously you don't care about your spelling in your speaking, but when people are worried about their grammar in their writing, and they say things like, oh, I'm not a very good writer, I don't have very good grammar, they lump spelling right in there. So we're going to talk about spelling, and it's worthwhile to spend a lecture on spelling, because seriously, what could possibly be more interesting than spelling? Actually, I'm not kidding about that. Spelling is another area in which the drought way of understanding takes tedious memorization and turns it into tedious memorization plus interesting historical knowledge. But seriously, spelling turns out to be a deep key to understanding language change and to understanding philology. And since I am a philologist, I wanted to talk about spelling. It's also the case that focusing on spelling is what really separates out people who love philology from kind of like every normal person. So people like, say, J.R.R. Tolkien, one of my idols and a great philologist, were very concerned with specific spellings because they told us something about history. Also, spelling's relevant because the reason that English spelling is so screwed up, is so interesting, is tied right into the ways that English grammar is so screwed up, complicated. So if we understand stuff about spelling, it's going to give us the foundation we need for the more complicated matters of large-scale grammar, which is what people would associate with grammar and which fits our definition. So that's why we're going to talk about spelling, and also simply because I'm interested in spelling, so you're stuck listening to it. No, I think you will enjoy this. George Bernard Shaw was famously irritated by the English spelling system. And in his will, he actually donated all the money from the proceeds of the play Pygmalion to spelling reform. Now, you say, what's a big deal? Well, Pygmalion is the source eventually for the movie My Fair Lady, which, by the way, is simply the best movie ever made about linguistics. Also, Audrey Hepburn. Now, supposedly, George Bernard Shaw, I say supposedly because it's one of these things that people try to track down the quote and then turn out they can't exactly find it, or someone close to the person said it, but it might be a ghost quote. In other words, that Shaw might never have said it, but people said he did, so I'm attributing to him. Actually, there's a very similar, possibly ghost quote that I brought up in another lecture, which is that when Abraham Lincoln met Harriet Beecher Stowe, she was the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, he said, ah, so you're the little lady who started the Civil War, which might not have been the most polite thing to say if Lincoln actually did say it. There's no proof that he did. So I'm just covering myself here. If someone comes along and sends me an email and says, you know, George Bernard Shaw never actually said that, I covered myself, but I'm still attributing it to him. Anyway, he expressed his frustration with English spelling by noting that the letters G-H-O-T-I could theoretically be pronounced fish. The G-H, the same as it is in the word laugh. The O, the same way as it's pronounced in the word women. And the T-I, pronounced as it is in the word condition or other T-I-O-N words. So, in this lecture, I'm going to show you why GH is sometimes pronounced F, why the O in women is pronounced I, and why the TI in TION is pronounced SH. I don't know, by the way, if this will actually help your spelling. Because, sad to say, one of the only ways that we, the educational establishment, the professors of language, have ever learned to teach spelling is to memorize huge long lists of words. And I can't really imagine anyone wanting to buy this course and listen to me dictate long lists of words and their spellings. Though if you do, email recorded books and tell them you want me to do that course. I could do a whole course on spelling, you know, if you can work it out with my producer. But talking about the rules of spelling will at least help you understand why the English spelling system is what it is, even if really the only way to be a better speller is to read lots and to copy out spelling words. The good thing is that we have spell check now, and that helps somewhat. Now, I'll start by noting that spelling is obviously a characteristic of a writing system, that none of the problems we have in spelling exist in purely oral cultures. They have their own problems, but spelling is not one of them. So we have to talk about writing systems and how they work, first of all, and then we'll build up to spelling and then build up to English spelling. Writing systems have apparently been developed several times in human history at the level of what's called the pictogram. Pictogram is simply using pictures of things to represent the things, or using written representations to keep track of numbers. That's where you get pictograms from. Now, think of Egyptian hieroglyphics, where like, oh, look, there's the cool little hawk's head, or there's the ox, or there's the bee, or something like that. You could arrange those pictures to indicate symbolic things. But the problem with a pictographic alphabet is that everybody has to know what the picture means. If your little squiggle is supposed to be a donkey, but the other person thinks it's a horse, you're going to get an entirely bad communication, or at least an approximately bad communication, or only a partial communication. And if you don't have a symbol for something in a pictographic alphabet, then you can't communicate that idea. Now, Egyptian hieroglyphs tried to do things that were kind of syllabic. So if you wanted to talk about something that started with M or ma, you could use the symbol for water, little squiggle lines for water, and then you could combine it with some other symbols to make a word. This is called the rebus system. By the way, rebus is just Latin for about a thing or related to a thing. But the problem with that is, again, that you don't really have agreement on how all the things work. However, we'll say that our present-day letter M comes all the way from the Egyptian symbol for water, and it's been passed on for thousands of years. A true alphabet was eventually developed by the Phoenicians and perfected by the Greeks, and it's only been developed one time in human history. Apologies, China. Apologies, India. I know there's a lot of nationalism there that wants to say the first alphabet. The Chinese system may be older than all the other systems, but it's not an alphabet. It's a character system. It's not based on sound. And the systems in India are not independent as far as linguists can go. So I appreciate everyone's national pride. People should still be proud of their actual symbols. But a real alphabet is a one-time thing invented by the Greeks, taking from the Phoenicians. A true alphabet is enormously powerful because then you can encode any word in the language. And the person reading what you wrote doesn't have to have memorized thousands of symbols, just a small core group that can then be combined and recombined. All they have to do is know what the word means. They don't have to know what the symbols mean. All of a sudden, human linguistic complexity can be encoded in words. That's why this is such a huge achievement. And I know, yeah, the ancient Greeks already have too many huge achievements, but this is one of theirs also. But of course, there are problems, and these problems underlie all the problems with the English spelling system. First of all, there's a debate over how many sounds human beings can make, and some people would say X, and some people would say Y. It doesn't really matter, because however many that is, it's vastly larger than the number of symbols in any alphabet. We have the International Phonetic Alphabet, which is supposed to be able to encode the complete diversity of all human speech, and it is a nightmare to learn. I don't even try to have my students learn IPA because there's too many symbols. And even then, International Phonetic Alphabet can barely keep up. There's not enough symbols. It's actually, a friend of mine who's a mathematician has said the same thing happens in math. You simply run out of symbols to use at a certain point. And so you're barely keeping up, and it's got a kind of dizzying complexity of its own. Now, the very fact that we need an International Phonetic Alphabet shows us a significant problem with all alphabets. They're conventions, and they don't always fit perfectly to the sound systems that they're representing. There are more sounds than there are symbols. And let me just remind you again that language works on sound. Even though we represent it in writing with alphabets, it works on sound, and the alphabets don't represent everything that we use. So let me give you an example. There are actually two P sounds in English. If you don't believe me, put your hand right in front of your mouth and say the word cup. Come on, just go ahead, do it. Say cup. Okay, now say pit. Do you notice the difference? When you say cup, your lips close and no air comes out. Cup, it seals off. But when you say pit, the P sound, there's a puff of air that comes out with the P. Those are two different sounds, and they're encoded differently in the International Phonetic Alphabet. But in English, we don't need two symbols for P because it's embedded in our rules of pronunciation. Nobody has to tell you, pronounce your aspirated P and your unaspirated P. But in other languages, that's a serious distinction. English doesn't use these contrasts, so we don't need them, but there are other sounds in English that do have contrasts, and we don't have symbols for them. So, for example, we have two different TH sounds in English. There's the sound in feather and the sound in theater. Put your hand on your throat and say them both. Feather, feel your vocal cords buzzing there. Theater, no buzzing. The difference there is called voicing unvoicing, and I talk about this in the History of the English Language course in much detail. But because we inherited a Roman alphabet, which itself was imperfect and was inherited from the Greeks, we had sounds in English that were not represented in the alphabet. So what do you do? Well, the Anglo-Saxons solved the theater feather problem by inventing a letter, which was based on a rune, called thorn. And thorn looks like sort of what you'd get if you combined a lowercase b with a lowercase p. It's got a little bump in the middle, and then it's got an ascender going up and a descender going down. So it looks sort of like a cross between p and b. Thorn was pronounced th, but it was pronounced either voiced or unvoiced. Then the Anglo-Saxons, just to make things more complicated, invented another letter called ev, which looks like a d with a cross over the ascender. So there's a little bar going up, and then there's a cross there for ev, which they also pronounced th. In Old Norse, they made a distinction between the two different ths, whether they used thorn or ev, but Old English really didn't. It just used both. Now, thorn and ev were used in English writing up until the Norman Conquest, then they were dropped, and then they made a comeback. But printers did not always have the correct letters for thorn and ev, which look weird. And so they would use, yes, the letter y, exactly what you would decide to use to indicate th. They would use the letter y to indicate th when they ran out of thorns and evs, or when they didn't have any in their fonts. So this is where you get those spellings in theme parks. It has ye olde suet house or something like that. That ye was never meant to be pronounced ye. No one in English history ever said, ye olde suet house. It was supposed to be pronounced the. It was just spelled using a Y to spell TH, which, again, I do not argue that this is not stupid, but it's what was going on. So it should be pronounced the. So when anyone gives you a nonsensical ye, you know that that's coming from literate, from reading things, not ever from hearing it. No one ever in the history of English ever naturally said ye old anything, because ye meant you, and it would make no sense whatsoever. So that's just one of the problems that was created. We didn't have enough symbols for the sounds in the language. Now, because I'm going to complain and criticize the English spelling system, I'm going to take a minute to put it into its proper context, because As bad as it is, it's actually not the worst spelling system on Earth. It's also not the best either. And not because there's like a competition for best spelling system or even for simple bragging rights, but because the complexity and difficulty of the spelling system is really significant for one important reason, and that is literacy. And this is one of my pet causes, so I'm going to give you a little literacy thing here. I used to teach in a literacy center in Chicago, and one of the big problems with people learning to become literate in English is that the spelling system is so complex. But it's not as bad in English as it is elsewhere. Let's take Japan, for instance. Now, you cannot think of a more high-tech, developed, scientifically literate country with a really exceptionally good educational system than Japan. And yet, they have fairly high rates of illiteracy. Why? Because the Japanese writing system is the most complex writing and spelling system ever created by human beings. It's got three different alphabets mixed together. Hiragana, katakana, and kanji. And some of those are syllabic, meaning they encode whole syllables, and some are based on Chinese characters, so they encode whole words or concepts, and others encode sounds, and they're mixed together, and it's very difficult, and it's very confusing. So says Drought, someone who's been trying to learn Japanese without as nearly as much success as I've had with many Indo-European languages. It's incredibly complex. Likewise, the Chinese system, which uses characters, pictograms with highly conventionalized meanings, rather than a true phonetic system, is not just hard for Westerners to learn. It's hard for Chinese people to learn, too. So the Chinese language is no harder than any other language if you grow up listening to it. You take a child, plop them down in China, they'll learn to speak fluent, perfect Chinese, just because that's how children's brains work around language. But Chinese writing tends to be much more difficult. And so here's why this is an issue. A kid who is borderline dyslexic may be able to pick up enough of the English system to be able to learn to read and write. The Chinese system becomes much harder for certain people. Certain people who have developmental disabilities have even more trouble with the Chinese system than they might have with English. They have even more trouble with the Japanese system. So there can be problems with literacy for those kids. And that's why spelling reform, though it's actually never going to happen in English, would be wonderful if it made it easier for people to learn the writing system. And it made it easier for kids who had dyslexia to learn how to read and write. If English were a better system, it would be better off for those kids. So I support spelling reform, even though, as I completely understand, it's never going to happen. Now, an interesting little tidbit about Chinese, by the way, is although Chinese spoken language has changed radically over time, the written language has remained remarkably stable. So people can read things that are hundreds and hundreds of years old in Chinese and read it fluently. You don't have to have an old Chinese class to read very old Chinese. However, as you can imagine, there are other problems, but people from different dialects and different time and places can still read the language. So there's a great strength for Chinese. Now, let's contrast all of this complexity with the Korean alphabet, which is usually considered to be the best alphabet ever devised. One of the reasons why is that it was developed rather late compared to other alphabets, but the Korean alphabet is almost a perfect fit for the Korean language. And in fact, some people, though there is some argument about this, think that the Korean alphabet actually shows the position of the tongue and the teeth in the mouth so that you can look at a particular Korean letter and know what sound to make from it. And then there's other linguists who say absolute nonsense, you're just, you know, projecting there. But for whatever reason, Hangul, the writing system, is a great fit for the language. And Korea has some of the lowest illiteracy rates, the highest literacy rates in the world. And I think some of that, as well as in a good educational system, as well as, you know, people who care about reading and writing, is also based on having a good alphabetic system. Now, as a little aside, J.R.R. Tolkien, one of my heroes, tried to create a more logical and perfect alphabet because he didn't like the English alphabet, didn't think it was logical. As he pointed out, only P and B make any linguistic sense because they're really the same sound, voice and unvoiced, and the letter B and the letter P at least look sort of similar turned around. So that's why Tolkien's Elvish Tengwar, his Elvish script, is the way it is. He was trying to create a perfect alphabet. And I know some people who have made the silly argument, again, because it's never going to happen, that we should just adopt Tolkien's Elvish alphabet for English, and then we'd have a good alphabetic system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, that's a nice theory. Now, not having enough letters for all the sounds was only the start of the problems with the spelling system. In Anglo-Saxon times, once you had settled on some conventions, for example, they used SC to indicate the sound that we indicate by SH. But you wrote down the words as you heard them, sort of a phonetic transcription, but using an alphabet rather than a complete set of phonetic symbols. And it worked pretty well. Come across an unfamiliar word, and as we say to my poor daughter, struggling with the intricacies of the English spelling system, sound it out. Which, as you know, in English doesn't always work. But scribes could do that. They could sound it out. And this is particularly useful to us because when the scribes sounded things out, they did in their own dialect. So let's say you had a northern accent in Anglo-Saxon. You would write things down in a northern accent. And this is sometimes called scribal smoothing or normalization, that scribes will bring things either into line with a standard dialect or into line with their own dialect. So this is really useful to us to recover history, and it tells us how things were pronounced. But there are problems. Scribes were often copying other scribes, and they were doing things from books rather than from living speech. So they would smooth things out, normalize them, bring them into a standard form. And so although some influence came through, there was more kind of corrected spellings in the sources to match the dialect. And soon, certain spellings became locked in by the tradition. This wouldn't have been too much of a problem, except that, as you know now, the language had been going through rapid change. The language was changing, and the spelling, some of it was changing and some of it was staying the same. And that sometimes gives us the form of a word before it changed, which is excellent, but other times it creates a problem because the word was no longer pronounced the way it was spelled. Again, excellent for the historical philologist, not so great for the reader or writer of a living language. Now, due to the specific history of English, we end up getting a huge influence from French spelling. And that might be confusing enough, but then after the separation between England and France around 1200, French spelling and pronunciation continued to change in its own way, so that present-day French is not a good guide for the French spellings in English. Let me give you an example. Anglo-Saxon handled the CH sound by just using the letter C in front of the appropriate vowel. So if you had certain kind of vowels, you would automatically pronounce C as CH. So if you see C-I-L-D, it's chilled, child, not killed in Anglo-Saxon. But French scribes brought in what we call a digraph, that's two letters, C-H, to make that C-H sound. However, in French, this sound later changed from ch to sh. So words that were borrowed before that point have ch, or what were native words, like child. But words that were borrowed later are pronounced sh. So we have church and child, native words, but machine and chauffeur. Think how confusing that is. Same digraph, two different sounds. Now, my favorite excuses for bizarre spelling can even come from fashions in writing. At one point, very, very angular writing was popular. Very straight, no curves writing. And this might have looked good, but it made it really easy to confuse the letter U if it was next to an M or an N or another U or a V or a W. So, for example, if you had UM, you just had a bunch of lines, some that were linked at the bottom and some that were linked at the top. If you had MU, it looked almost exactly the same. So, writers were confused. What are you going to do? You have U and you have M and it looks the same and I don't know how to do it. And this is why we spell the words money, honey, come, wonder, cover, and love with an O, even though the pronunciation is U and it's always been U. So in fact, the cutesy pie way of spelling love, L-U-V, is right. That's how love should be spelled. But because you didn't want to confuse your U's and your V's and not know what the word was, you stuck an O in there for that sound. This is one of the things that drives people crazy about English. Then there's the introduction of extraneous letters put in by members of my own tribe, the professors, for the purpose of making a perfectly natural English word look more like its Latin cognate. So, for example, we have the word debt, and we have the word doubt in English. And the Latin sources for these words are debita and dubito, which both have B's. But the actual historical source was not Latin. It was French, which had already lost the B. So French had dette and douta. And so it comes into English, debt, doubt, no B. And then in the 18th century, someone says, you know, that's probably from the Latin debitum. Let's put the B in there. And so there's completely extraneous, useless, never pronounced letters stuck into words. J.R.R. Tolkien, by the way, writes a whole story called Farmer Giles of Ham around this kind of learned stupidity, saying at the very end of the story that spelling Thames, like the River Thames, T-H-A-M-E-S, with an H is a folly without warrant. Similar to this folly without warrant is the spelling of who, what, where, when, and why. The old English pronunciation of these words was the combination of the H sound and then the W sound. So you would say hua and what. Now, this pronunciation still lurks around in, of all places, the upper Midwest of America. If you hear someone say, where are you going, or what did you do? You can make a good guess that this person grew up north of a line that you can draw along the Missouri-Iowa border. I actually know some people, by the way, who have said that, you know, that what is such a pretentious pronunciation. There's nothing learned or pretentious about it. It's actually poor people pronunciation. It's lower classes who've not changed their pronunciation for a long time in England, who then immigrated to America and brought that pronunciation to the upper Midwest. But what's learned is the spelling. The Anglo-Saxon HW sound hung on for a while, but eventually the sound changed to plain old W. But because we had other digraphs in English, like CH, SH, and TH, where the H is just indicating totally different sound, I spent lots of time in my childhood, and this is probably why I ended up as a philologist, trying to make th make th, or sh make sh. You know what? They don't. It's not that at all. It's simply a spelling convention. It's a digraph. So what happened was that to make it consistent in spelling with TH, SH, and CH, decided to spell it WH instead of just plain old W or HW. Okay, so that's some of the background. I haven't gone into all the different insane spelling rules because it's not possible. Though again, if you want a whole course on it, you know where to send the email. But let's explain how the spelling G-H-O-T-I could be pronounced fish. And then this will tie us back to our bigger idea of grammar. Let's start with the G-H being pronounced F. What birthed this monstrosity? Well, let's go back to Anglo-Saxon. Anglo-Saxon H, in certain positions in a word, was pronounced with a kind of throat-clearing sound you might hear in German Bach or Scots Loch. The Old English word for laugh was chlechan. So there's that h sound, right? Chlechan. As time went on, H by itself became used for what's modern English H, not the h sound, but just a straight like hotel or hot, a regular old H. And then, as well as standing by itself and making the hot or hotel sound, H was paired up with T or with S or with C to make sounds that we often call hushed sibilants. The throat-clearing sound came to be represented by GH, because you needed something to put with an H to make that sound, because the regular plain H no longer had it. But then the word underwent an additional consonant shift. What happened is GH, the ha sound, right, like lach, as it would be pronounced, lost its voicing and became just pronounced F. So our spelling fossilizes the older pronunciation. Chaucer probably would have said lacht, but then became laughed, but it was still GH. And that's where the F comes from in the fish word. Okay, the word O in women is even worse, but it's pretty interesting. Because the ending in the plural, men, was different than mon, weef mon kept that first vowel the same pronunciation, the I sound. So what happened was woman was the evolution of the singular, but weemon was the evolution of the plural. But the spelling stayed with the original pronunciation. So you have W-O-M-E-N pronounced women. That gives us the I sound in our fish word. Finally, why is T-I-O-N pronounced shun? Well, as you might guess, we can blame the French. T-I-O-N is a suffix that comes from Latin but through French. It's used to form abstract nouns from verbs. So you have the verb starve, you can create starvation, revolve, revolution, and so forth. The Latin pronunciation of T-I-O in French was tio. But it gets consonant shifted in English from tsio to shio, and then it becomes shion, and eventually just shun. But the ti spelling from when it was tsio is still there. So if we take that ti as being part of the tion complex, it gets the phonetic value of sh. Put this all together then, we have gh pronounced f, o pronounced I, and ti pronounced sh, and that gives us fish, spelled G-H-O-T-I. Now, let's tie this all together with the bigger picture of grammar and how to use it. English spelling system, as big a mess as it is now, follows a deep logic, but only if you know a huge amount of linguistic history. Learning that history is not easy. It means, for example, that you have to read books like the Reverend Walter W. Skate's Principles of English Etymology. And let me say that I believe I may be the only person under age 40, probably the only person under age 50 or age 60 or age 100, who has actually read this 550-page book cover to cover. You've already figured out I'm weird like that. And I've started us out with the spelling system because the influence of history is so clear and obvious here, and the chaos that is current English spelling is so obvious. So understanding spelling and trying to find some logic in it is connected to one of the twin goals of this course, to improve our grammar so we can be better at following the standards, even though we also recognize that these standards are arbitrary and even stupid. But again, language is social. You have to communicate with other people. If you decide to spell fish G-H-O-T-I, you better hope that other people are going to read it that way, or your whole point of writing something down will not be useful. Spelling's also tied to the other half of the drought way and the major aim of this course, understanding how English works. Spelling is itself a kind of grammar, though not in the sense of arranging words, but in the sense of arranging sounds. If you come across a rule like, when a consonant is followed by an H, we have to read the two letters as a digraph and treat them as representing some different sound rather than the consonant plus H. That's a grammatical rule. When we retain the spelling of K in knowledge, but don't pronounce it, but we do pronounce it in acknowledge, we are applying a set of kind of quasi-grammatical rules. Spelling's also tied intimately to grammar in a few cases. For example, we say one goose and two geese, one tooth, two teeth, one moose, two meese. Wrong. We're using spelling to indicate grammar, the way we do with ring, rang, rung, but we are not being consistent. And the reason, by the way, that the plural of moose is not meese is that the word moose is a Native American word that was borrowed after English had given up the process of making what we'll call strong plurals. Later on, we're going to give this what I would call grammatically significant spelling the annoying name of morphophonemic rules. But for now, we're just going to state the idea that there are grammatical relationships in spelling as well as in the arrangements of whole words. It's better to be a good speller. It's better to have your words be consistent with the dictionary. It's better to have you have no little red squigglies under your writing on Microsoft Word. It's also better to use the correct fork at dinner. But at least with spelling, you have several centuries worth of excuses for why you haven't gotten it exactly right. So, the drought way is to understand why spelling is a mess. Try not to make a mess yourself, but also not to get too worked up when someone else makes a mess, because that person may not have had the benefit of the drought way, which is why you should loan them this course. Well, we're done with spelling, and now in our next lecture, we're going to move finally to whole words and classes of words. We're going to talk about what used to be called the parts of speech, but which we're going to call word classes.
This ends Lecture 4. Remember to visit this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures you just heard.